Welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. This fine day in January, we hear a lot about postmodernism these days, and not just amongst philosophers, where the term's been in use for some decades. In the general discourse, it appears to become one of those fairly imprecise swear words. And the internet is littered with polemics against postmodernism, which gets lumped in with feminazism, socialism, liberalism, leftism, cultural Marxism, and a whole load of other extremely imprecisely employed terms, in which the words get dragged screaming away from their original meaning. Now, I'm not against semantic drift, it's inevitable. But what we're seeing in a lot of modern political discourse in Western Europe and North America is a willful obfuscation. So that debate is just extremely foggy and muddy. It's the equivalent of setting smoke bombs off on a battlefield so nobody can see what the hell's going on to create more confusion. Anyway, so it seems to me. I do see a few people out there trying to revisit some terms and dig around in the primordial political philosophical texts which have founded our political culture, and through that means to get some kind of clarity. I was reading a guy the other day, I don't know who he is, he operates under an avatar name, but talking about modern conservatism and its roots first of all in Aquinas, 13th century, and then more immediately in Edmund Burke, writing in the 18th century. And it was extremely clarifying. And I think there's work needs doing of that type, so we can actually have a debate again. Because really, it's almost impossible. I mean, there does seem to be a big rift between the old world and the new world on the terms like liberal, socialist, and quite what it means to be a Marxist, and so on. I think what's happened is that the internet has given rise to an intensification of pretty well all discursive activity, but particularly sloganeering, propaganda, and the meme, you know, the catchphrase, the slogan that can be shouted at a rally or on a march or in a riot. And the internet lends itself to the meme, which can have a graphical content as well. So I think on that level there has been an impoverishment of political and general discourse, even though at the same time we've got more real information, or good information, and good argument and good analysis available to us if we want it. I suppose in some sense it's the age-old story of who can mobilise the mob will win, perhaps. Well, sometimes they do. Not always. Anyway, the impression I'm getting is of a generalised chaos, of a melee. So the term postmodernism, it gets abbreviated sometimes to POMO. And you can see why slightly overdrawing what it originally entailed can be blamed for things like post-truth and alternative facts, and so on. But I would say that this is hardly fair to the original ideas and the original employment of the term postmodernism. I think the term actually was first found in discussions of architecture, and postmodernism was a kind of eclecticism in architecture that was a reaction to the sort of brutal architecture of Le Corbusier and so on, and concrete and the undecorated mathematical grey brute concrete of the 60s. Some people love it. It's pretty ugly to me. And the case of people's living conditions being determined arrogantly from above by an elite with an idea and an obsession. But I think as a reaction to that, you got the idea that you could mix up styles and you could add decoration again, and mix up materials and go for colour, and through a sort of collage method, produce something more exuberant and less severe, less austere. And it was, I suppose, at bottom a simple reaction against austerity and stark reason, with a kind of a romanticism of colour and playfulness and a degree of irrationality, perhaps. So I'm going to mention now Jean-François Lyotard, who wrote a paper quite a while ago. Again, the date, I can't remember, but it's ages ago. I mean, Lyotard's been dead for some time. I think I was still a student when Lyotard died, so it's ages ago. But anyway, Lyotard wrote a paper. It's called The Postmodern Condition. And there's this famous characterisation of the postmodern condition, in which Lyotard says, the postmodern condition is characterised by suspicion towards grand narratives. And Lyotard saw this as a cultural trend, which it most certainly was and most certainly is. So, okay, what does this mean? First of all, what is a grand narrative? And what is it about a grand narrative that we should be suspicious towards it? Well, a grand narrative is what I would call a metaphysical system, usually. And it's an attempt to explain everything with one overarching story. And by a story, I mean an account of things in general, which are very coherent, in which all the various concepts fit together and depend on each other, and which there is, yeah, there's a deep coherence to it. And it will explain everything. It tells us what the world is like, what the universe is like, what we are like, what consciousness is like. It also tells us things like what's right, what's wrong, what the desirable future is, what will happen to us when we die, what our duty is, and so on and so on and so on. You can answer pretty well any of the major conundrums that human life attracts by reference to the system. So that's a grand narrative. And that can have a political tenor. And I think actually Lyotard was reacting against Marxist systems as much as anything else, which on the basis of a notion of how the world works and what we can know and particularly all this at the social level, did have this kind of grand narrative characteristic, and it was starting to look fishy. Well, kind of basically Stalinism, indicated quite how fishy it was. Even though you could easily argue that there were other practical reasons and other forces acting at the time, which pretty well guaranteed that the Stalinist project would fail. So, do we need to be suspicious of such grand narratives, of such overarching explanations, such meta-metaphysics, or meta-narratives they're sometimes called? Well, certainly. And, of course, Nietzsche, in the 19th century, really acted as a grandfather for this idea with his hermeneutics of suspicion leveled just about every metaphysical concept, including the granddaddy concept of all metaphysical concepts, God, the Judeo-Christian creator God. Oh, Nietzsche, well, God is dead. You know, and that's a shorthand way of saying that the whole idea of erecting huge metaphysical systems with which we can then guide our lives and our social organisation and just about every aspect of life is one that really doesn't hold, and it doesn't have the firm foundations that once was thought. Now, I mentioned Thomas Aquinas earlier on. Of course, this Aquinas erected the huge theological system, the huge grand narrative, which to this day informs the Catholic Church. And this is one of those typical pyramidal grand narratives that is supposed to absolutely guarantee and explain everything, with the key concept, the keystone concept of God. So Nietzsche's there having a bit of a go at it. I mean, it's already, these lines of thought have been floating around in discourse and in the conversation of humanity since the year dot. Protagoras, man is the measure of all things. You could argue that's the founding moment of postmodernism and postmodern suspicion of any kind of transcendental explanation, like Plato's theory of forms. And, you know, quite a bit later on, Jean-Baptiste de Vico, some people place the postmodern Genesis moment there with de Vico's work. So are we right to be suspicious of grand narratives? And, well, I think yes. I think Nietzsche's criticism certainly are razor sharp. And of the whole apparatus, really, you know, including such things as like truth, logic, cause and effect, as well as God and time, the way time's understood in these theological explanations. And for Nietzsche, the point of most severe criticism is the point where the grand narrative attempts to lay out values, give us a table of values by which to live. And Nietzsche found them wanting and wanted to develop his own. When Nietzsche's project, as he characterised it at the end of his life, was to revalue all values, to evaluate value itself and to find a way forward in what seemed by then a stagnant, uncreative impasse in some ways, at least in terms of social development. Now, we might not like Nietzsche's personal values, whatever they were. I mean, they're not as easy to discern as people think. But nevertheless, this project, one can see that it's one that should be undertaken, the re-evaluation of all values. In fact, getting a much clearer handle on value, per se, than we've got. And if you go back over these podcasts, you'll notice this keeps cropping up. But what Leotard is saying, Leotard isn't necessarily doing the job of debunking grand narratives for us. He's reporting that it's a cultural phenomenon, that for a great many people, particularly educated people, in what we loosely call the West, and post-modernity, by which he means like after 1900, I think, are suspicious. This is like a cultural reportage. We are, as a breed, suspicious of grand narratives. You know, we tend to say, oh, well, oh, yeah, yeah, the withering away of the state, oh, yeah, the dialectics of material production, blah, blah, oh, yeah, yeah, and the dictatorship of the proletariat. Pull the other one, you know. Oh, there's God, and underneath God there's the archangel, there's the Son and the Holy Spirit, and then we've got the archangels and the angels and the seraphim. And go on, pull the other one, you know. Also, I remember there were a lot of difficulties in logic and epistemology and concerning notions of truth at the back end of the 19th century and then onwards. I mean, key features in that development would have been Wittgenstein's critique of Russell and Frege employed. Wittgenstein's switch from the philosophy of the Tractatus to the philosophy of the Philosophical Investigations. Gödel's indication of the huge, insoluble conundrum at the core of Principia Mathematica, in which Russell and Whitehead had tried to give firm foundations to mathematics in logic, and Gödel indicating pretty conclusively that their theory was either complete but inconsistent, or consistent but incomplete. And this boils down to telling us at the most fundamental level of our reasoning that there isn't really a foundation, there is nothing solid to rest it on. And that sort of debunks the Cartesian project of foundationalism, of looking for something absolutely secure on which to build the edifice of our reasoning, and for building the edifice of our mathematics and logic. So, I mean, you could go on in this vein. And this kind of culminated, I suppose, about the middle of the 20th century with a philosophical movement that despaired of finding foundations, of stopping the argument about quite what truth is, of figuring out what value is, and so on. And so out of this insecurity, there's a kind of slide into relativism. Well, okay, one idea is as good as another, even though I don't think that is a true implication of postmodernism. I think that what we should draw from postmodernism is that we return to phenomena, or in Husserl's terms, you know, we return to the things themselves. And I would widen that out to say that we come back to our ordinary lived experience, maybe to common sense, even though, of course, common sense can be questioned. And we use science to question common sense. I mean, common sense doesn't tell me that this little gate here on the path is nothing but patterns in a of vibration and possibility in a quantum field or whatever the thing is, or a bunch of vibrating quarks. Yes, science certainly has carried on apace, fueled by the fact of how useful it proves. Now you see why there is a backlash to the death of God, because epistemologically, psychologically, it leaves us very much more insecure about knowing who we are, where we're going. It also places responsibility on us. If God is dead, you can't pass responsibility back to God through the priesthood. You can't cogently and logically hand over responsibility for your decisions to a priesthood who will tell you what to do in every circumstance, because they've got the master plan to refer to that will tell them what to tell you about what you should do, what you should think, what you should feel, what you should feel guilty about, what you should be regretful of, what you should be joyful of. So postmodernism actually puts responsibility on our shoulders, but I suppose we now try and slough that off by saying, oh well, yeah, that's just your opinion. You know, or one story is as good as another. But for a lot of people, it's painful. So you do it, so it's almost inevitable there'll be a backlash, which of course there is. And I think the backlash isn't necessarily conservative in a political sense. It might be conservative in a cultural sense. Because you get a backlash from doctrinaire, old-style Marxists, socialists. Because they would like to be certain that they got the answer too. I mean, the whole project depends on a kind of a messianic certainty when it comes down to that level of psychology. If you weren't certain, why would you pursue anything that's potentially so disastrous? If it did turn out in the end that you were wrong. So, I think in summary, Leotard's analysis, characterisation of the postmodern condition, it's too far off. I'm just on the simple level that I know 2% of the British population, whatever it is, go to church regularly. 150 years ago, it was everybody. In fact, you had to, otherwise you were in trouble. So, for a whole host of reasons, some of which are to do with the way in which philosophical and political and cultural discourse has developed, we do live in a condition of suspicion of grand narratives, particularly religious ones, and particularly the big political projects. Certainly in Europe, if you hope to attain some political power, you have to put on a coat, at least, of sort of pragmatism, willingness to be a bit eclectic with your ideas. So you have the idea of, you know, social democracy and a mixed economy, which are capitalist elements, but also command economy elements, where the state owns some things in common. Railways, health service, mines, whatever. And they have this idea that there's sort of coexistence and a bit less purism. And that's postmodernism. It has the eclecticism, but it also has the suspicion to the big solutions, you know, the big, based on big pictures, dogmatically held. And I would say a grand narrative always has to have a dogma at the centre. God exists. And you can use all sorts of things to do that signifying job of being the linchpin or the foundational concept. It doesn't have to be God, it can be history, capital H, truth, capital T, self, capital S. There's just a whole load of ways you can do this. And it's more about reproducing a structure of ideas. Okay, I think that only scratches the surface of postmodernism. But I hope I can kind of convince you not to hear it as a swear word and realise when it is being used as a swear word that it's not actually doing justice to the huge conversation around the term postmodernism that's gone on for some decades. And if we want to use the term usefully, we need to at least have a sense of that conversation. And I suppose it's a plea not to fall for sloganeering. Do your research and think. And, of course, meditate as well, because you'll think better. And think because you'll meditate better. So I'm going to leave it at that. And think about this as being a bit of an introduction to hopefully a few other episodes with some other aspects of postmodernism and maybe some other thinkers. Thanks for listening.